Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, in this era of dumbed-down discourse and toxic partisan division, a call to action for universities. John Sexton has been president, dean, and professor at New York University, and he believes institutions of higher learning need to think of themselves as having an obligation to create sacred space for open dialogue, which includes making room for speakers some people find offensive. We'll talk to Sexton about how universities need to evolve to operate in a globalized world and about what it will take to make college available to every capable student, regardless of socioeconomic status. Our conversation starts after a short break. Racism, poverty, climate change, terrorism, we have some complicated problems to tackle in the modern world. But when we try to talk about these things, all too often we just pick a side, ignore nuance and contradictions, and resort to name-calling and vilification of those with whom we disagree. Where can we look for a better example? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest today believes universities can be a beacon of rational, respectful discourse, resources for learning that extend themselves far beyond any given student body and into the communities, the countries, and the planet in which they operate. But it won't just happen. Institutions of higher learning will need to make important choices that position them to model productive, truly diverse ways of thinking. And hold on, because that will sometimes mean making room for ideas we find upsetting. John Sexton is President Emeritus, Dean Emeritus, and Benjamin Butler Professor of Law at New York University. His most recent book is called Standing for Reason, The University in a Dogmatic Age. John, welcome to Think.
Nice to be here, Chris.
So what worries you about the state of public discourse today, and how long has it been as bad as it is now?
Well, let me tell you a story which sets the tone, I think, for the book, both positively and negatively. In a high school classroom in 1956 in, as you can tell from my accent, Brooklyn, a great progressive man who later became a leader of the peace movement, Daniel Berrigan, wrote on the blackboard four Latin words, extra ecclesia nulla salus, outside the church there's no salvation. And I went up to him after class and I said, Father Berrigan, does that mean my best friend Jerry Epstein won't go to heaven because he's Jewish? And Danny Berrigan said to me, John, if you don't baptize him, he won't go to heaven. 60 years later, I could be at a conference with leaders from 25 faith traditions. My first doctorate is in the study of religion, so I'm in the conference. And each of us is talking in a great ecumenical conversation about how knowledge of the place where each of the others stands enriches our own understanding of our own faith and of theirs simultaneously. Meanwhile, back in 1956, and this gets now directly to your question, my dad was a political leader in Brooklyn, and he worked with people from all parties to get the things done, like getting the snow cleaned and the garbage collected and food on people's tables and making sure no one was suffering from a lack of education. 60 years later, we find that we've developed as a society a kind of secular dogmatism that is even more virulent than the theological dogmatism that was manifest by Danny Berrigan's triumphalism in 1956. And we no more can talk across dogmatic lines about our political views than Jerry Epstein and I could have a conversation about the resurrection or the virgin birth. So there's a complex set of factors that's been growing up over the three generations in between. And you can trace it back. It's not a recent, it's not the last 2 years or 5 years. You can trace it back. I've been tracing it for two generations. And we find ourselves standing and looking at each other in political dialogue and saying, how did they ever get to be that way? I mean, we're at a point where 40% of Republicans and 40% of Democrats each see the other party as a threat to democracy. So this is highly corrosive. It's untenable in a participatory democracy. We have to do something about it. And we can talk about the factors that lead to it. But the key thing is it's there, and it's there in a way that must be addressed.
So you had Father Danny Berrigan in your life. You also had an early mentor that somebody once described as having the body of Orson Welles, the voice of James Earl Jones, and the soul of St. Francis of Assisi. Tell us about Charlie Winans.
So if you went to a set of men, it was an old boys high school that were produced in the period that Charlie was at this Jesuit high school, and you just randomly said to a random group of them, who was your greatest teacher? 90% would say Charlie. He affected lives, and he certainly affected my life. Now, he arrived in my life in 1955 as I entered high school, and the Jesuits had just received him. He was a layperson. He was not a Jesuit priest. He was a layperson. He had just done his doctoral studies at Columbia in English, and they knew they had magic in a bottle, and they didn't quite know what to do with it. So they took a small group of us, 12 of us, and the 12 of us each day, 5 days a week, from first period of the day, probably 8:30 to 9:30, had this man for a course they just called Charlie. And we had him for 4 years. First period of the day. For this course, Charlie, and he, this is before anybody ever talked about interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary, and he started with the cave paintings at Altamara and percussion music on that first day, and brought us up through the millennia, simultaneously teaching us history, literature, art, and music. One quick vignette, I remember when we got to the Old Kingdom in Egypt, we had read the Book of the Dead, and we had read the Shakespearean plays, and we knew the history of the Old Kingdom, and he had music in the background. He's got the Pyramids of Giza, slide machine projecting onto the side wall. And he looked at us, because we were all street kids from Brooklyn, and he said to us in that voice of his, "Boys, you will never see these pyramids, because you can't drive to them." Because we hadn't have the money to get on a boat, and there weren't even intercontinental planes at the time. We certainly couldn't get on the ones that existed. But he continued, he said, "But boys, there are pyramids south of here. You just haven't heard as much about these pyramids because the bleep British didn't rob these pyramids for their museums." So there he was talking, 60 years ago about the provenance of art, Eurocentrism. And he gave us a phrase which, frankly, I've gotten some plaudits for things that have happened at NYU during my time as a dean and a president. The plaudits should go to Charlie, not to me, because I'm just taking his theme and playing it out. And his phrase that he gave us back then was, "Play another octave of the piano. Play another octave of the piano. If there are notes you haven't touched, reach out and touch them. If there's a food you haven't tasted, if there's a music you haven't heard, if there's a place you can get to you haven't gotten, and crucially, if there's a person who is of a type that you've never met before, embrace the wonder and diversity of creation. Expand. Don't look just through one window. Look through the many facets of a diamond." And this was now, remember, the same year that Danny Berrigan said those words. So here I was mired in Brooklyn Irish Catholic triumphalism, really, on the one hand, in a very narrow world. And this seer, this prophet was calling us out before we thought there could be a Catholic president, before the Vatican Council had happened, before we ever heard the name John the 23rd, or began, as I studied for my doctorate in religion, reading people like Teilhard de Chardin. So Charlie kind of laid the seeds for a worldview that was embracing, and he inculcated in us a view that was decades ahead of its time, really.
It's such a painful irony, John, that as so many Americans have begun to heal their animosities toward people of different religions and embrace more ecumenical views, we have a much harder time with people who see the world different from we do from a political perspective.
You're so right. I mean, a great piece of data that I came across in writing this book is that, again, using 1956 and 2016, in 1956, 3% of Americans told pollsters that they would be upset if somebody in their family married somebody from another political party. Today, that number is 40%.
Hmm.
More than race, more than religion, more than ethnicity. I mean, just think about what that means. Now, when we started this segment, I said to you that the frame I set with the Berrigan story and the Charlie story, as you introduced it, it is a daunting frame, as you just put it. It's a shame, your word, a shanda, to use the Yiddish. It is. But on the other hand, the fact that we've had the 60-year arc, as Martin Luther King would say, in the direction of justice, the fact that we've moved from theological dogmatism to theological ecumenism, not universally, there's still triumphalists out there, but broadly, and we see the joy of that, gives me hope that there might be an antidote for this secular dogmatism that's developed. I call it an allergy to nuance and complexity that feeds a need for kind of a few words, a dogma, so to speak, doctrine, that capture a slogan is what we would say politically. We must be able to move, if we've done it theologically, from a political dogmatism to a secular or political version of ecumenism. And I'm happy to report that I have instances in my life and in NYU's life where we can see that there is a constituency and a real potency to what I'll call secular ecumenism.
So you think that universities could be at the center of this kind of healing, this move towards secular ecumenism. You don't shy away, though, from noting, as many conservative critics do, that university faculties are perceived, rightly or wrongly, to be overwhelmingly liberal. So first of all, do the numbers bear that out?
So I'm glad you bring that up. And there's a reason that I did this latest book with a university press, because the university press puts the contents out for peer review, and then in the back of the book there are footnotes to all the sources, because we're in this time when we have this explosion of information, some of which is simply fiction, and it's important we're able to curate. So I didn't want to do it as I did my last book with Penguin, even though Penguin's a wonderful publisher, because I wanted skeptical folks that were reading the book or listening to us today to know, at the least, that when I give data of the sort that you've just described, it's curated data, it's been peer-reviewed, and so forth. And the first thing is that there is a cottage industry out there. Let's forget which political side. We don't have to label it. It's actually on both political sides. But you're right that a lot of it comes from organizations like Turning Point USA, and which are pouring huge amounts of money into trying to control student newspapers, government, so there's a certain view of university life. But the data is very interesting, and this is strong social science data, repeatedly verified. The fact of the matter is that universities, and this is certainly consistent with my experience at two very different kinds of schools, but since 1981 at NYU, that they're not captured by a certain political viewpoint, that there's a robust debate that goes on in campus. I came from a law school faculty member meeting just last week, which was a jewel of an example of nuanced and complex discussion about the writings of someone we were considering for tenure. But to give you the data, in 1984, roughly 40% of faculty members self-described themselves to pollsters as liberal. That number today is still 40%. The predominant number today describe themselves as moderate. And most importantly, the conservative faculty members report that they're more happy on campus than the liberal ones do. We can talk more about this the other side.
All right. My guest is John Sexton. He's President Emeritus, Dean Emeritus, and Benjamin Butler Professor of Law at New York University. His new book is Standing for Reason, The University in a Dogmatic Age. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with John Sexton, who is President Emeritus, Dean Emeritus, and Benjamin Butler Professor of Law at New York University. We're talking about his book, Standing for Reason, The University in a Dogmatic Age. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. So you dropped kind of a bombshell, John, just before the break and said self-reported, self-described conservatives, faculty members on campus, say they're happier than their progressive colleagues. What's that about?
Well, I present this data in the context of saying that the stereotype or the conventional wisdom about universities, especially universities at the level of the elite universities like NYU, where I've lived since 1981, are politically captured. And the data just doesn't support it. I gave you the data on the distribution of faculty. And the dominant self-describe as moderate. That's 46% in the most recent surveys. But a 2016 very extensive survey that was done reported that whereas 58% of liberal professors indicated they were happy with their academic careers and the context of conversation on campus, 66% of the conservative professors said so. And you know, this is you have to think of this across schools. You know, people are in business schools or law schools and in science labs or English departments. Things might be different in individual departments, but it's quite impressive in debunking this notion that there's kind of been a liberal capture of our universities. And I can tell you from the experience of someone who, you know, in a year will be celebrating his 60th year of teaching, not all in universities. I started in high schools, but I've been in university since 1965, and the fact of the matter is that there is robust debate on our campus across a broad spectrum. Certainly, to define what I mean by a broader spectrum than is presented by the political views of the nine justices on the United States Supreme Court, for example. And that's true in our law schools.
Just to push back for a minute, what about all those self-described moderates? I mean, they can be, you hear that term and initially we think, great, they fall between the conservatives and the liberals. Might they be, in fact, left of center, many of those moderates?
Well, if 51% when pressed, as you press, self-describe themselves as Democrats and 36% as independents and 14% is Republicans. So, you know, you get down to what do each of those words mean. But if the ideological capture message is accurate, you know, one would think there's a certain social cachet in identifying as liberal. But the plurality group is not doing that. So that says something right there.
So what's going on that 58% of Republicans in this country surveyed think that universities have a negative effect on the direction of this country?
Well, I think there's a very powerful message that comes out from this kind of cottage industry that's in the business of attacking everything from the value of a higher education. And then let's remember that our colleges and universities are one of the important institutions in our society, and there's been a widespread, and this is across the political spectrum, growth of a kind of culture of distrust and a loss of faith in institutions and an increasing political attack on institutions themselves. Now, this clearly is destructive of the common weal in the broad sense. But it seeps into this, that universities, strangely, which are the vehicle, or at least should be. I'm not going to claim universities are perfect. You know that that's not a theme of my book. But the universities, which at least ideally and more than any other institution I can think of, are instruments of upward social mobility. Nonetheless, they're seen as elitist institutions. Because, you know, a quarter of our population goes to higher education. Maybe it's up to a third now at all. And even fewer go to the elite schools.
So you think it's really important for universities to be open to speakers of all different viewpoints, including those who can be expected to offend certain numbers of people, maybe who have offended you at times? Talk a little bit about that, because it's become a thing that I think a lot of people can't quite decide where to fall on this issue of inviting a speaker that some people think of as offensive onto a college campus.
That's actually a perfect segue, because here, I think that folks would believe, based upon broad media reports coming out of this cottage industry, that there's a kind of epidemic of speakers, and they probably would say conservative speakers, although the banning of speakers occurs on both ends of the political spectrum. When in fact, what goes on in campus is that now there are 5,000 colleges and universities in the United States. I would say that in a given year, tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of external speakers — we're not talking now about speakers on campus, but external speakers — are invited to come in and speak, and they are across the entire political spectrum. It's remarkable when you check the data, and there are organizations on both sides of the political spectrum that monitor this data very carefully. When you check the data to see how few disinvitations actually occur — they tend to be the ones that dominate the news. But in the most recent data that's available, which is from 2017, out of these tens or hundreds of thousands of speakers that come to campus, there were only 35 cases of people being disinvited, and that was down from 48 the year before. So the first thing to understand is that this is another version of what we were talking about the political capture of universities, that universities by and large invite people from across a very broad spectrum. Internal to the university, I fear, and now I'm talking as a university president or a dean, I fear that the pressures that come from outside — and I faced myself even before I was announced as NYU's president. Now, I was coming from being dean to being president of the university, but this is in 2001. The Clinton administration was ending, and as dean of the law school, I was running a major event which featured, among others, truly was led by the man who would be the former president, President Clinton. And I got a call from the person who at that point was, and still is, the university's largest individual benefactor, saying to me that he would never give to the university again if Bill Clinton appeared on campus. And, you know, I said, that's just not the way we run the university, and I'm very sorry that we'll lose your benefaction. And we went ahead with the conference. That person is a virtuous person and has continued to give very generously to the university. So defending the principal did not lose the university anything, but it could have. And there was a moment there where, you know, I had to make a decision as to whether or not this principle of bringing in someone where this external pressure was coming would cost the university too much, and I decided the principle of inclusion was too great to compromise. Now, the interesting thing is, on the other side, this person probably would have been very happy if, after he got on the plane leaving the White House, Richard Nixon had been invited. Mm-hmm. But then there would have been other people on the other end. I want to emphasize, I'm not making this as a particular political point. This happens all the time. It happens sometimes with the authority of government behind it. So there are external threats, but then there are also internal threats to the dialogue in the university. And we have to be very vigilant about them as well. Orthodoxies develop. And you said earlier that one of the principles in the book that I espouse, and it's really important, is that there can be no final resting point for thought. Thought is a constantly evolving process. And yesterday's orthodoxy can be shattered, and it sometimes can be shattered by from an angle that those who propose the orthodoxy don't see. So you have to be very careful about methodologies and orthodoxies, even in departments and scholarship, to make sure it's balanced. Now, who does that? Because it's hard for the people who are spending their lives in the world of thought. I'm now talking internal to the university. It's very hard for them to step out of the picture and judge themselves. But then you see the wonderful processes of a university, the constant dialogue that occurs, the fact that the work that's done is put out the way I've put out my book, and it's transparent, and it's subject to debate, and people write articles taking issue with elements of it or supporting elements of it. So that debate goes on and occurs. And the job of a dean or a president, and a lot of what I write in this section of the book is about the job of the dean or a president, in my view, and my view is a minority view. I did my doctoral dissertation on Charles Eliot, the president of Harvard, who really invented the bully pulpit. He felt that his voice should speak loudly, not only on behalf of Harvard, but on behalf of himself to direct public policy broadly. Many presidents feel that way. I took the position that for the 28 years I was dean, 14, and then president, 14, that I lost my rights of political expression publicly. I could do it at the dinner table. But I said, no one's really interested in the views of John from Brooklyn. They're interested in the views of John, comma, the dean, or John, comma, the president. And you know, in a diverse community like NYU Law School, you take an issue like criminal justice reform or the death penalty or any issue of public policy unrelated to education, there'd be broad views. There'd be some people in the law school that favored the death penalty, some that opposed it, some that were this and that. You know, sometimes yes, sometimes no. So also on every political issue. And I did not have the right, I felt, and this is the view I espouse for a reason I'll explain momentarily, to draw down on the political capital of the entire community, the right-hand side of the comma, John Sexton, comma, president, the right-hand side of the comma. I didn't have the right to draw down on that to enhance my own political views. More importantly, if I did so, when there came a moment where I had to intervene in the conversation on campus to create a breadth of expression, to create a diversity of ideas, I would have compromised my moral authority because people would say, oh, he uses the university in his own way. By refraining steadfastly and sometimes with great difficulty. I mean, there's one incident when I was dean of the law school. My daughter is a lawyer at Legal Aid. She wasn't then, but she is now. Rudy Giuliani, our mayor, was an NYU Law School graduate. The chairman of Legal Aid was a college friend of mine who had, it wasn't known yet, but he had given to the university a multi-million dollar gift to create a chaired professorship in my name when I stepped down as dean. Some people said it was to get me to step down as dean, but I didn't take it that way. But in any case, he's the chair, and he calls me up and he says, John, Rudy Giuliani has cut Legal Aid funding. There are 12 law schools in the New York area. 11 of the deans have signed a protest letter to him about that. You're the only one that hasn't signed. And I said to him, Tom, here's the principle. And I explained it to him. And I said, you know, Tom, if I sign your letter, then I am saying about every letter I don't sign, every button I don't wear, that that's less important than your cause. And now I'm in a quagmire where my moral authority to act as a kind of steward of the diversity of viewpoint on campus is diminished. So I think it's really important for presidents and deans to think this out so that they can play that steward's role. And we have to. There's a lot to fix inside the university. There are a lot of attacks, like the kind of conventional wisdom that you've alluded to a couple of times so far in our discussion. There's a lot that has to be done to make the universities closer to their ideal. But I'll tell you this, universities, because of the way they advance thought and the methodologies of there being no orthodoxy, of there constantly being reevaluation, of the breadth of the conversation, of the transparency and the requirement of transparency of viewpoints, they have in them the possibility of an antidote to this secular dogmatism.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So you say that listening, John, is among the deepest manifestations of respect, and you don't think many universities are doing enough to cultivate listening as a value.
I spent the world of time, 20 years almost, in and around competitive debate. And what people don't realize is that in a competitive debate, not the kind of thing we call presidential debates, but in a competitive debate, there has to be an extension of the argument through four iterations by each side. And the quality people miss in a champion debater, I've been around national champion debaters. I've been one myself. I coached five national champion debaters. The number one quality is listening. Because if you don't listen carefully to your opponent's viewpoint, you can't answer it. And you certainly can't extend on the argument after they use some nuanced extension of their first statement of the proposition. And it goes through four extensions in a debate. And by the way, there's the added feature that you don't know which side you're on until the coin is flipped before the debate. That's kind of the paradigmatic, you know, discourse exercise. But that's the way our universities have to be. And this means that we have to inculcate in the citizens of the university, faculty and students, an ability to listen. And then that means, and this gets into a whole other set of issues, that those of us like me who have had the privilege of voice, I could even add the adjective dominant voice, the privilege of dominant voice, have to get in the habit of giving those that have been largely excluded from the conversation a chance to speak in a way where we're actively listening to them. My colleague Carol Gilkin calls it aggressive listening. And then trust can build and real dialogue can build.
My guest is John Sexton. He's President Emeritus, Dean Emeritus, and Benjamin Butler Professor of Law at New York University. His newest book is Standing for Reason, The University in a Dogmatic Age. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes, and we will be taking your calls at 800-933-5372. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is John Sexton. He's President Emeritus, Dean Emeritus, and Benjamin Butler Professor of Law at New York University. His book is called Standing for Reason, The University in a Dogmatic Age. You can join us at 800-933-5372, and that's where we find Steve on the line in Dallas. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
You had mentioned a minute ago about the distribution of professors in universities, and when you break that out by department, you will find a wide disparity in political and ideological perspectives. The humanities, the soft sciences are dominated by left-leaning professors, and your hard sciences are going to have a higher number of conservatives. And I personally don't think that universities, they've created the problem, and I don't see them as the solution at all. I see them as creating echo chambers, academic echo chambers.
Well, thanks for calling. Do you want to respond to that, John?
Sure. You'll recall I made the point earlier that that you had a break down the data as Steve does, and although I think that his statement of it kind of has the tone of the general misunderstanding of academic life, that it pervades the dominant conventional wisdom, that the spectrum he presents is certainly correct. I mean, but I want to emphasize within the humanities, within the social sciences, you'll find vigorous debate, and certainly in my own discipline where those hit the road, so to speak, in terms of policy, you find it. And I think the humanists who generally feel devalued in the present political climate nationally, but also feel devalued inside the university. They're paid less than the other groups that Steve denominated. They feel essentially underappreciated inside the university. They'd be very surprised as the people he describes as the most liberal that they were dominant. Now, as to the universities causing the problem, that's where I have to really part company with Steve. I mean, I'm not denying that universities are under the same kind of trends that we find society generally, but the loss of faith in our institutions did not begin with universities. It began with our government, and it began with our religious institutions, and then, you know, did we ever hear of Enron down in Texas? Our corporations. In my book, I facetiously say it started when the Dodgers left Brooklyn, because then no institution was safe. But you know, it took a long time for it to get to universities, and the general culture of distrust which permeates our society. I mean, 85% of Americans tell pollsters they don't trust their neighbors. And this is not an accident, by the way. And in my book, I go back and as long ago as 30 years ago, I quote a political consultant who wrote a 80-page memo to his constituents. I'm not even going to identify which side of the political spectrum they were on. It's not important for the point. But wrote to his constituents, his clients, that they should begin in their speeches a systematic attack on institutions of law, judges, and lawyers. It was an easy applause line, and it was his words, nothing too vilifying, you could say. And I remember reading that as a law professor, and at the time I was the head of the Association of American Law Schools, the president, you know, for a year, a volunteer kind of thing. And I wrote a pastoral letter saying, you know, this is what de Tocqueville said binds our country together, the institution of law, and here we're beginning to attack it. So this attack on institutions and the loss of faith in institutions and the chasm of distrust of those with different views didn't start with universities. And universities structurally, as I say, because of the way they allow no orthodoxy inside any of the disciplines Steve mentioned, and they you have to put your ideas out in writing for examination by others, and they're tested by time, and people around the world test them, not people only in your locality. Structurally, universities have in them the capacity to introduce a kind of what I'll call secular ecumenism. I'm not saying they're ideal. I'm not making that case, but I try to lay out the ways in which they can get closer to the ideal.
So you encourage universities that have the resources to reconceptualize themselves as international or even global institutions. But as you acknowledge in the book, there are people who say that sounds a lot like intellectual imperialism. That sounds like the Americans, you know, planting themselves in Shanghai or Cairo or wherever else, and saying our way of educating the world is the best way.
Yeah, so this, again, I'm going to make an analogy to religion here, because there was a moment when my field, my ultimate field, as I got my doctorate, which was comparative religion, played that way, you know, where it was religion X, in the case of my studies, Christianity, going out and missionizing the world, and other religions were seen as inferior. And we moved through that. There's no doubt that education can be used as a tool of colonization or imperialization or so forth. All you have to do is see the movie about the British arrival in Australia called The Rabbit-Proof Fence, where they were taking kids from families to civilize them. Yes, it can be that. But that's not what I propose. And my proposal here is not an abstract proposal. My proposal here is exactly what NYU has done. And as my successor, Andrew Hamilton, wrote in a recent letter, now more and more of top universities are doing, and for every one that hasn't done it yet, 10 are thinking about doing it. And this is not economic globalization. This is, it's essentially secular ecumenism. It's saying that if you really want to challenge orthodoxy, then what you've got to do is invite in viewpoints from every sector of every society, because each of those sectors in each of those societies provides a facet of a diamond to look at something instead of looking at it just through the window. It's like Charlie said, play as many octaves of the piano as you can. Embrace people that are different from you. So, for example, and this is kind of proof of proposition because it's been such an extraordinary success now, moving into its 10th year, NYU Abu Dhabi arguably is, there is no one finest or anything because you have to say what's right for a particular student. But in terms of sheer quality, NYU Abu Dhabi offers an education that is the most ecumenical and most extraordinary in the world. You have 1,500 students there in Abu Dhabi, fully integrated into NYU, with 144 countries represented. The largest contingent is the American contingent, which is only 15% of the student body, and they're not in their own country. And they come from every sector of society, because the theory behind NYU Abu Dhabi, NYU is a private university, but in NYU Abu Dhabi and NYU Shanghai, which are the two other main campuses other than New York, in those two places, we have full government support. We do all the decision making. We run the curriculum. We hire the professors. We exercise the academic side. But it's the way America was largely before 1980, when higher education was seen as a public good. Except in the case of NYU Abu Dhabi, the government there has said, "We'll support this. We'll support it completely." But consider this the university to create the leadership of the world and bring them from every sector of every society all over the world. So just one quick example to give you an idea of how this is the opposite of colonization, because we're learning. Those students are circulating through because they can study away in New York. They can study away in Shanghai. They circulate through the campuses. But in the first class, there was a young man named Musba who homeschooled himself through the first eight grades in a tribal village in Ethiopia. Then as a 13-year-old, he walked for 5 days by himself to Addis Ababa, asked the international school to give him any admissions test they wanted. Of course, he got the highest score in the cycle. They admitted him. They found out about 6 months in that he was living alone by himself in the airport. They gave him housing. He was their valedictorian. He came to NYU Abu Dhabi with the full support of scholarship aid and graduated magna cum laude and is going back to his tribal village to create a school that will formalize the education he homeschooled himself with. And if you multiply that with 144 different countries, every sector of every society in those countries, because the supporters see it as a public good for the world to create an ecumenical leadership for an integrated world. And they just won the World Debate Championships over there. And the two teams, the two people on the team were from India and Pakistan. So, you know, you've got students learning to live and love each other together as a community of communities without giving up their identity. That's the hope. That goes beyond. Job one is using the traditional university to kind of be an antidote to this dogmatism. Then job two is getting beyond that to a kind of secular ecumenism. And I think universities can do that. And NYU and other universities are proving it can be done.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So you stress here that it's important that all of us work together to make a university education available to everyone who is academically capable and motivated. Tuition, room, and board for an undergrad at NYU is $76,000 per year right now. What do we do about the fact that a lot of students don't even consider applying to college because they just can't imagine affording it?
Well, they can't imagine affording it, and some of them are told college doesn't make a difference, and others are told it doesn't make a difference where they go to college. Now, you know, your figures are right about NYU in New York, and we work hard. We now provide for financial aid for students that allows many, not enough, and NYU New York is not where we would like it to be. NYU Abu Dhabi and NYU Shanghai are on a model where higher education is a public good, and nobody bars to go to those schools. Generally, we have to, as a society, and now let's focus on American society, because there's a scandal that exists. About 40 years ago, we took a political turn in this country, and we started treating higher education as a private good instead of as a public good. I mean, for heaven's sakes, in 1862, in the middle of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln knew to create the land-grant colleges. He knew higher education was a critical factor for our society, both economically in terms of generating ideas and for upward mobility. We began to move away from the idea of higher education as a public good, and now we've essentially said to many, you got to borrow. Now, it's still worth doing, by the way. When you net out all of the borrowing that's done, and by the way, here again, there's a kind of fiction out there. If you look at the debt that students have, and the fact of the matter is that 43% of college graduates have less than $10,000 or no debt at all. And 65% of those that have debt that's less than the cost of a car. And a car devalues the minute you walk it outside. So, again, there's a lot of misinformation out there. But we should not be forcing students to go into debt. And we should not be allowing students to be where you said they were, that they just think they can't go to college or they shouldn't go to college or it doesn't make sense to go to college. Because the average college graduate ends up, when you net everything out in constant dollars, $500,000 better off in lifetime earnings than if they don't go to college. So we've got to identify kids. And there is a huge socioeconomic problem here because there's vast undermatching. I'll just give you one piece of data because I know we're running against the clock. If you look at the students that are in the top 20% of SAT takers, so these are kids that have, they're thinking about college to the point where they've taken an SAT or a teacher's gotten them to take an SAT. You look at the top 20%. Now, you've already lost a lot of lower socioeconomic kids that don't know to take the SAT, which is a whole different issue. But I'm just focusing on this one piece of data to show you the problem we got. 25% of the low-income students, the ones that are in the lowest economic quartile, 25% of them don't even apply to college. Whereas if you look at the highest economic quartile, only 5% don't apply to college. These are kids that have high SAT scores. They don't even apply to college. We've got to get better college counseling out to these kids. We've got to let them know that it makes a difference, that it makes a difference where they go to college. Because the ones that go to college, systematically, the former president of Princeton, Bill Bowen, wrote a great book on this years ago. Systematically, they go to less good colleges than they should, and they do less well because they're not stimulated. We've got to turn this around, and there's a way to do it, and I describe that in my book.
John Sexton is President Emeritus, Dean Emeritus, and Benjamin Butler Professor of Law at NYU. His new book is Standing for Reason, The University in a Dogmatic Age. John, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It was fun.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think and use any podcast app to become a subscriber to the Think podcast. You can check our website at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.